Chapter 2. When they arrived at the airport and checked in at the counter, Giles discovered that 2 first-class tickets had been reserved in their names. He contemplated keeping such news a secret until it was time to board, but she saw the look in his eyes when he joined her at the security gate, of course. When she asked what had him so chipper, he handed her ticket over, and she glanced at it briefly before looking back at him with wide eyes.
"Who set this up? Your company or theirs?" she whispered.
"Mine, I suspect. Reggie said that he'd arranged the flight."
"Remind me to send Reggie some flowers," she giggled.
"Oh, excuse me," Giles laughed. "I might have had something to do with it, don't you think?" She cocked her head.
"Such as?"
"Well, my dear, one of my stature. Wouldn't you think I warrant the treatment?"
"Don't joke like that," she said through twisted lips. "It's not attractive."
He laughed it off, but wondered deep inside if he had spoken completely in jest. And just what was wrong with supposing he had earned a perk or two along the way? There had certainly been plenty of 90-hour work weeks in recent history. Why not cash in a little on the notoriety? It was nicer by far than hearing his name dragged through the mud by all the crazies in the news, at least. They were ushered onto the 777 after those families with small children and the infirm. Anna counted off 3 rows until she found their seats along the port side of the fuselage. She stood looking at the seats for a moment while Giles pressed their carry-on baggage into the overhead bin. A few passengers muttered in annoyance as they shuffled by. What they had by the window could not properly be referred to as seats, more like couches. There were 2 of them, taking up as much space as any 4 coach seats, with a high partition wall wrapping around their perimeter. She saw an additional wall dividing the couches they would share, though it had been retracted back so the window seat could be accessed.
"Oh my God," Anna said, and began to laugh hysterically.
Some more passengers had backed up behind her, and one of the attendants up by the forward galley asked her to please take her seat. She blushed and ducked into the window seat with her eyes cast downward. Grinning, Giles settled into the aisle seat beside her, marveling at its comfort and the sprawling legroom. There was a bin in front of him at the other end of his cubicle that looked purpose-made to hold his laptop bag. He leaned forward to stow it, and then laughed as his wife had when he realized he could not physically reach the bin without getting up from his seat. As he hunkered before the bin, he got a closer look at the black widescreen monitor set into the partition wall, larger than the TV he'd owned in college, saw the padded platform beneath it, and examined the gap between that platform and his seat. Understanding what the configuration must mean, he glanced back at Anna over his shoulder and said,
"These things convert into beds. Get out."
"No, I'm serious, look." He touched over the controls of her chair for a few moments before he found the button to recline the seat back and pressed it. Instead of the backrest reclining, the seat slid forward until it joined the footrest far on the other side of her cubicle. She was prone and laughing again. Other passengers glanced down at her as they passed, some of them bemused, while others smiled at her unfiltered glee. These passing expressions on strange faces only incited her further, and she was soon gasping for breath. When she had herself under control a moment later, she reset her seat to its upright position at the request of the same attendant who had called out to her earlier.
"Now are you 2 going to be a problem?" she asked kindly.
She wore a smirk that looked like breaking away from her control in a most unprofessional manner.
"No, ma'am."
Giles smiled, and Anna put a hand over her mouth to stifle the slight grunting buried in her throat.
"First time on this end of the plane, you guys?"
They nodded happily. Then her smile really did break forth, and it was as attractive and welcome as they both felt. Her lipstick was perfect, and the set of her teeth so flawless Anna thought they must have been constructed by an artist. She lowered her voice and said,
"Wait till you try the meal. Listen, you guys, drinks are free, but take care, okay? It's easy to lose track your first time out."
She glanced back over her shoulder as though confirming she was not overheard. Giles wondered if she was violating some sort of corporate policy, but found he did not mind. He imagined her job consisted sometimes of a long line of entitled asses. He nodded to her, and in all seriousness said, "We'll be fine. We're not heavy drinkers." The attendant, her name tag said Melody, nodded and advised them to wave if they lacked for anything at all.
They departed not long after, and when they heard the soft chime denoting the 10,000-foot mark, Giles was shocked at how quickly it had come. He had flown in recent years, yet the 737s he frequented always took longer than this to find cruising altitude. The swept-back wings of the aircraft sliced through the sky like razors with hardly a jostle, and he wondered if it was just good weather or if the aerodynamics of the plane were really as impressive as he had read. It rocked gently beneath his body as if it were a platform on a slow-moving gimbal, and his eyes began to droop despite his excitement. A moment later, he heard the clack and clatter of numerous bags being unfastened, of trays being lowered, and chairs adjusted. The sound washed through the cabin like a breaking wave. He caught his wife's eye at this signal, who had until recently been staring through her window in rapture, and they spent the next 20 minutes or so playing with their seat controls like children. The first portion of this activity was dedicated to toggling each other's overhead light, abandoned as soon as they realized the flashing might annoy their neighbors. Anna graduated to systematically inflating and deflating the air bladders in her backrest until she achieved the perfect amount of lumbar support. On his armrest, Giles discovered a black square of plastic about as large as 2 credit cards laid side by side. There was a picture of an old-fashioned pointer device on its surface. He looked closer and found the declivity along the panel's edge that, when pushed, folded the panel out of sight, exposing a muted gray touchpad. As soon as he discovered this, the display beyond his outstretched feet ignited in a ballet of twirling colors and pleasing imagery. The words, "Try me," were shown along the bottom, so he touched the panel under his hands with a fingertip. The swirling hues coalesced into an interface menu offering such services as movies, television, games, books, and so on. "Hey, Anna, check this out," he said with a smile. She leaned forward to see around the retracted partition wall and noted what he was doing.
"Very nice," she said.
"Isn't it?" he agreed.
"Care for a little TV, my darling?"
"Oh, certainly, lovey," she joked in the drawn-out guise of the obnoxious aristocrat. "Do let's see if they have the arts." He began to tap through a few channels, the content of each being previewed in the main window as it was highlighted. He reached the domestic news stations, and 2 channels after was greeted by the image of his own face looking back at him. He stopped scrolling for a moment and stared.
"Babe," Anna said.
The amusement in her voice had died. She looked up at him and saw the worry lines return to their familiar places, eyes stricken and hurt. Slowly, as though controlled by an external intelligence, his hand rose to set the bud of an earphone into his left ear while he tapped another control on his armrest. He waited a moment, then sagged. Anna fumbled with the panel in her own armrest, cursing under her breath before discovering how to retract the cover and was searching for the channel a moment later. When she found it, she inserted her own earbud and listened. The news was not good. Protests had broken out in Washington, with an organized mass march at the center of the fray peopled mostly, it seemed, with various privacy advocacy groups. She watched for a few moments more as a man she thought might be the head of the ACLU was displayed within an inset picture, decrying the abuses and violations of the Guardian program and shouting angrily about the latest mask laws currently under congressional debate, the growing wave of cities adopting the technology, the further alarm over the coming deployment of the voice upgrade. His image was soon supplanted by footage from one of Giles's interviews from over a year ago, where the extremist Philip Armitage had famously attacked him with, of all things, a phallus caked in human excrement. The larger picture switched to a scene of screaming people being rounded up and hauled away by police officers dressed in riot gear. At the bottom of the screen, she saw the text, "Earlier today."
"I imagine they'll start calling the house again," Giles said quietly.
"But we changed the number," she muttered.
"They'll find it. They always do. I suppose it's high time I cancel the landline altogether. Superfluous service, really.
Giles. Giles, turn it off, honey."
"It's okay."
"No, it's not okay. Turn it off. I don't want to see it." He glanced at her, then looked around the cabin. Some of the other passengers nearby were looking at him curiously, perhaps recognizing his face mirrored on his own seatback display. Perhaps they were watching the same channel at their own seats even now.
"All right," he said,
and exited to the main screen. Then he closed the cover of the mouse panel. The screen went dark, replacing the image of his face with the reflection of his face. He lowered his head and sighed. Anna's hand crept around the partition and found his.
Are you okay?
Oh, sure, he nodded. Just par for the course.
Can we watch a movie? She tried.
Yes, of course. He reclined his seat fully, and when she followed suit soon after, they discovered that they were no longer separated by the stump of the divider. They looked each other in the eye for a moment, and then she leaned across the gap and kissed him softly.
Sorry, he whispered.
She shook her head and kissed him again. They dimmed their lights, and Anna found the least insulting film she could, a task that seemed of increasing difficulty as the industry progressed each year. Holding hands, they watched a comedy devoid of all personality for 15 minutes or so before Anna finally drifted off to sleep, her last reserve of energy having been expended in the day's excitement. Giles waited for a while to ensure she was all the way out before extracting his hand. He dug through the overhead bin until he found a cellophane-wrapped blanket resplendent in airline livery and, removing it from its package, unfolded it. He draped it over his wife, retrieved his tablet from the laptop bag, and returned the couch to an upright position. A few seconds later, he was connected to the cabin network and perusing the initial volley of email from Anagnorisis. There appeared to be 5 of them interspersed throughout the stack of spam, interview requests, accusations, and absolutions. Some of these were standard boilerplate messages, welcome to the family, and so on and so forth in various superficial degree. He thumbed through these absently in search of meat. The final message they had sent contained what he sought. Here was the initial non-disclosure agreement he was to read through and sign before even stepping foot within corporate headquarters. He parsed carefully through its content, looking for any hint regarding what he now flew to discover. It was as imprecise in its precision as any legal document he had ever considered, at once excruciatingly detailed and confounding in its total lack of meaning, until he thought he might very well be signing over the rights to the next decade's worth of his labors. He chewed through it laboriously at least 4 times, finding when he was done that he perhaps understood less than when he had begun. He scoffed, shook his head, and tapped the box that would apply his consent to the document. Then he opened a browser and began to scour the internet for anything he could find related to Anagnorisis Technologies LLC, most notably anything appearing to overlap with his own recent developments in the fields of emergent AI research, deep learning, pattern recognition or extrapolation, and adaptive artificial neural networks. There seemed to exist a few hopeful articles. However, they were just as careful about their IP as was his own company, so there was very little to sink his teeth into. He began to look at articles regarding recent stock market activity, searching for any clues as to areas in which Anagnorisis might recently have directed its interests. The attendants started taking dinner orders up and down the aisles when he stumbled upon a recording of an old TED Talk, now some 15 years old, in which a middle-aged engineer, Kevin Roth, discussed the importance of carbon nanotubes in the coming era, the massive industry shift to be engendered by the advent of an economical and bountiful production process for these perfect little structures. Kevin Roth, who was now, as luck would have it, the chief technical officer of Anagnorisis Technologies LLC. Giles spent some time thinking about this, trying to understand how such a technology might impact his own field. But he soon found that whatever he imagined amounted to little more than what the engineers in his department called a WAG, wild-ass guess. He was distracted from his train of thought when Melody leaned respectfully into his area and quietly asked what he preferred for dinner. He nudged Annalise gently until she stirred and looked about bleary-eyed at her surroundings. She seemed to be shocked to find herself sleeping fully prone on an airplane.
"What is it?" she mumbled.
"Dinner, hon." He passed her a menu and asked, "Do you know what you might drink?"
"Give me a..."
she said, bringing her seat up. Giles nodded at the attendant, who said, "I'll come back in a few minutes."
"How long was I out?"
Anna yawned.
"Not so long."
He glanced at his tablet. "Close to an hour."
"Hungry?" "Starving."
"Oh, well, good. Have a look and see what sounds tasty."
"How is the movie?"
She yawned again. Oh, it was very sweet. They became romantically involved, despite all of the circumstances conspiring to keep them apart. Then around the second act, there was some contrivance of plot to drive them apart, and then at the end, they reunited and lived happily ever after. Turned it off, huh?
Indeed.
She snorted, opened the menu, and after reading for a few moments, whistled gently.
Indeed, Giles repeated, having opened his own menu.
Melody came back not long after, and Anna ordered halibut with rice pilaf, while Giles limited himself to a simple salad. They both had a glass of white wine with their meal, pronouncing all to be excellent, though in truth it was merely adequate by any rational standard. Enjoying these things as opposed to the regular array of cattle-class peanuts, fossilized cookies, and flavorless cold sandwiches, in other words, those things with which they had until only recently an exclusive knowledge, at 35,000 feet seemed to elevate the experience, if only psychologically. In time, Giles had his plate taken away and was scrubbing his hands with a hot towel, while Anna still worked daintily at her supper. He pulled his tablet from the pocket of his armrest and began to peruse the last page he had left open.
"What you got there?" asked Annalise.
"Hmm?
Your tablet. Anything good?"
I don't know."
He muttered and fell silent.
"Did you eat your brownie?"
"Hmm.
Honey?"
He put the tablet down.
"What?"
"Your brownie, honey. Did you eat it?"
"Oh, no. Thought I might save it."
He went back to reading. He made it perhaps two more sentences down the page when he saw her hand creep stealthily around the divider wall like a lovely pink spider. It began to pinch at the fabric of his pant leg and tug gently in furtive little jerks. His mouth contorted into a smile despite his best efforts to resist. Reaching over to the armrest, he retrieved the brownie, still wrapped in its packaging, and slowly brushed it against the knuckles of that softly tugging hand. It froze briefly, and then latched onto the brownie like the snapping jaws of a saltwater crocodile. Her hand retreated back around the divider, the doomed brownie already an abandoned possibility in his mind. A moment later, he heard the packaging crinkle, and then through a demure mouthful, the voice of his love muttered,
"Thank you."
He nodded and continued to read.
"You know, it won't be just me that you have to share with one day. At some point you'll have to choose."
"Hmm. Honey?"
"Hmm."
"I said you'll have to choose."
Giles lowered the tablet again and thought for a moment.
"What are you talking about?"
"Your brownie. I was saying that someday you'll have to choose who to give it to."
She let the thought hang. He worked it over for a moment before his face fell.
"Good sweet Jesus. You're not saying you're—"
"No," she answered quickly, a little alarmed.
"No, I was just saying at some point we might, you know."
Giles took a few deep breaths to steady himself and then sighed.
"Well, thank heaven for that."
He resumed reading.
"I didn't realize you'd find the thought so terrible," she said.
She placed the uneaten half of the brownie on her plate. She no longer desired it.
"It's not terrible," he muttered. "It's just not a good time."
"Not a good time? I didn't ask if my parents could come spend a week with us, Giles. I'm talking about a baby. What would you consider to be a good time?"
"Not now," he said absently.
She reached into his cubicle, grabbed the tablet, and shoved it down into his lap.
"Can you pay attention to me a moment, please? I feel like this is kind of important."
Rolling his eyes and sighing, Giles said,
"All right already, what? What's so important?"
"Giles," she began,
then stopped. She required a few moments, it seemed, to bring her anger back under control. He waited for her impatiently, tapping his foot, and she felt her temperature rise.
"When is a good time, huh? If now isn't a good time, when is? I'd like an answer, please."
Leaning his head back against the seat, he said,
"I don't know, baby. Honestly, have you been here the last couple of years? How often have I actually been home at a decent time over the last 6 months? Half? Half of the time I've managed to get home before 11? How many times in the last couple of years have I dragged a sleeping bag along to the office?"
He shook his head and sighed.
"It's not a good time. This project? I'd be a shitty father right now. You'd be like a single mother, and I don't want to do that. You'd end up resenting me, or worse. I don't want to end up resenting you now, she said.
Do you?
No. Not yet.
He snorted.
I understand, honey, I really do, but what can I do right now? The work is what it is. Once we found a little system maturity, maybe, but we're not there yet. We're working on it, trust me. I'm busting my tail just to get there. When will you?
Soon.
No. When?
He looked at her curiously.
Are you laying down a deadline?
What if I was?
He took a deep breath.
I'd say I deal with enough deadline bullshit at work, thanks, and about the last place I need it from is my wife.
He lifted the tablet and resumed reading. She watched him silently for a few moments. Then she reclined her seat and tried to go back to sleep. When she failed to find sleep, she pretended.